Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Cast Erebus Doctor Who podcast. I'm Christian Cawley. He's James McLean. And we are here to discuss the return of Doctor Who yesterday, which was Halloween, with the first part of Doctor Who Flux, the six-part series of, well, I mean, it was kind of expected to be linked stories, but it's more serially, though, isn't it, by the look of things?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of quite exciting. We watched it last night, my wife and I, on iPlayer. We didn't watch it live, which I'll come to in a minute. And we got to the end, and there's like a cliffhanger, and she said to me, so it's basically like it was in your day. But there's 7 years between us, and she said your day, like she was talking to her granddad. I was not impressed.
No.
Did you watch it live?
I didn't know. I was planning to, but I didn't know. I watched it on iPlayer.
Right. No, I mean, it went out at 25 past six, and that is kind of, for Halloweeners, that's kind of, it's of, I mean, this isn't kind of accurate, but to small children, that's kind of the witching hour, isn't it? So I think it's a bit of a strange time to put it out. I can see why they've used it to open the series, though. It's a really, there's a lot in there, and it's obviously, it's got that Halloween tie-in in there as well. I'm going to be quite honest to get started. I think I do this usually anyway. When the Halloween apocalypse started last night, I prepared myself with a can of cider. I was really prepared to be really disappointed, as I have been with many other stories in the Chris Chibnall era. And by the end of it, let me wind back a couple of nights. We were watching Remembrance of the Daleks the other night, and I was observing that when that went out, it was like the most exciting thing Doctor Who had done in maybe since, if not the Five Doctors, then Earthshock. It was just so exciting and punchy, and you didn't know what was going to happen next. And it wasn't slow and podding. It was just really fun. And I got a similar feeling watching Doctor Who last night.
Yeah, it's interesting that kind of ties into, I don't know, a lot of people, including myself, sort of speaking of Jodie Whittaker's era as being a little Colin Baker-ish, and it's sort of inconsistency, and I don't know. And then, you know, using McCoy as the sort of return to form, or his second season's return to form, almost feels a bit like this. I don't know, that's probably a bit of a stretch of a comparison. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I know, going back, I remember when I watched Remembrance of the Daleks for the first time, I was quite a nervous child, and the things now which seem just like Doctor Who, I remember seeing as a child and seeing through the Dalek eye, and there was the sort of discordant electronic music which played over the top as it was shooting soldiers. Mm. was quite punchy, and I wouldn't say scary, but a little unnerving. It's funny how those sort of things, and yet when watching this last night, there was bits in it which I was thinking, yeah, as a kid, I'd find that a bit disconcerting with the character, which I think is being labelled Swarm. He's not been named yet.
Yeah, yeah.
His intro, I thought, was very well handled. Was quite visceral in some of the sort of his the way his body reacted, some of the shots and the lighting, the digital lighting around his transformation was also quite shocking. But I don't think it would be stuff which would, you know, create massive nightmares, but it would be the sort of stuff that, as you say, Doctor Who of old would have put you behind the sofa, stuff that unnerved rather than frightened. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I went in, I'll be honest, I loathed the open. The cold open,
yeah.
This is the stuff of Jodie's era that I loathe. And I just, and not just Jodie's era, I mean, we've seen it in Moffat and Davis.
Yeah.
Where it just kind of trivializes the notion of threat in the show, and the notion of of believability. Where it sort of lends itself to too much farce, and it wasn't even clever farce. It felt artificial. The dialogue felt like it was overly. It was overamped. It was trying too hard.
Now, the cold open, this was the Liverpool in 18, whatever, wasn't it?
No, I'm talking more about the acid pool.
Oh,
Hanging
God,
her
I've
over the
forgotten all
acid
about
pool.
the. Because there's a lot of flashbacks in this, and I'd completely forgotten about
That is
that, which
true.
wasn't even a
That is
flashback.
true.
Yeah.
Well, so them opening up with them hanging
Yes.
upside down over the acid pool, I
Yes.
should have clarified.
Yeah.
I found that just, I found the whole sequence just bad. It just did everything which I thought it shouldn't be doing. And yeah, that was the only bit of the show that I thought was bad. I thought the rest of it was really, really good. It just, yeah, it was, as you say, I think the format, and I know I don't want to be sound like we're trumpeting our horns. We've been saying for years now that maybe something like this might invigorate, the six serial episodes, six serial stories rather than episodes. Would invigorate the format, and I think it has. It felt like Doctor Who, but it felt like it was being able to do things in a different way, in a way that felt Doctor Who.
Yes.
So having his advance on the station, watching the world, watching the galaxy, and then the flux, that felt very Doctor Who, but it didn't feel forced. I wasn't sure where it was going to go because I knew it didn't have to resolve in that episode. I didn't know whether that was going to be like, because if that was a standard episode, and not obviously knowing where that character's going to have input later, you'd have thought that would be a moment where you'd have a guy on a space station who sees the threat then destroys the space station, last you ever see of him, and that's what it's there to do, to mark the threat and a reaction to that threat. And yet you knew when you were watching this that the show didn't have to do this. It could do that. There's a lot of people who just died in that show very quickly, in that episode, but it didn't have to. And that was, I think, an invigorating feel. It's like, I don't quite know where this is going to go because I don't know how this is going to stretch out over six stories.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And I mean, there is so much packed into this episode as well, which we understand is going to pay off later on in the series. So there's Weeping Angels, there are Sontarans, Dan Starkey back again as a Sontaran. The other one was Jonathan Watson, and you've also got the whole thing with Dan. One thing pops up with Dan, John Bishop. I'm not a huge John Bishop fan in terms of him being a comedian, but I've watched him act before and I've always been impressed at how good he was at it, actually. He was in a thing with, a few years ago with, I've forgotten what it was called now. It'll come back to me later. But there's a quote from him in the episode, the line of dialogue, where he goes in the TARDIS and he says, "I had a mate who had one of these. I think it was bigger, a bit bigger, actually." And, is it a joke, or does he have a mate with a TARDIS?
That sounded that sounds like something, having lived, I mean, obviously you live in northern terrain, so I suppose for you Liverpool is more Midlands than it is north. And I know there is obviously big debates over that from people in the UK, in England, of what is north and what is south and where the divides are. But that felt very Liverpudlian to me. As it was a wonderful, I really liked how they did his character. I don't know John Bishop particularly outside of seeing him presenting and in interview, but I thought the way that he played it and the way that the character was written. And I think it's probably a moment to sort of say as well that for the amount of aggravation that Chibnall gets, as Davis has had as well, and Moffat has had, but especially with Chibnall, it's nice to see things where you can sort of see why that person is a showrunner, why that person is a writer, because you get used to so many people just saying, he's a terrible writer, he doesn't know what he's doing. And people used to say that about Davis, and they've said it about Moffat. It's nice when you see these professionals able to do something which really exemplifies where their skill sets are. And I thought he wrote that really well. I thought that Dan was a really enjoyable character. It was really nice to have a male companion who is just such a nice guy, such a gentle guy. I thought it was really interesting that when his house is broken into, he never actually threatens apart from calling the police. And even when he's captured, he's only sort of threatening to tell people that he's been kidnapped. You know, there's a real gentle way that that character's been written. And I think that's just kind of refreshing. I think it's also refreshing as well because we often have companions who start in a need to be somewhere else because they're just underutilized where they are. And you could argue that with Dan, I guess, that he's a kinder person and the world seems to let him be. But you don't feel like there's a need for him to, you don't feel a dissatisfaction with him that he needs to go on some roller coaster ride with the doctor. There's a feeling of centeredness, which is unusual for a companion. And I really like that. I thought that really worked well. So yeah, Dan was good. I mean, I suppose we'll talk about Centaurans next week, but I thought the Centauran designs were interesting. How much love and attention there were to trying to emulate that sort of 70s aesthetic while keeping, as you say, Dan in there as a as the you know as the emblematic 21st century Centauran character was, and yet very much disguised. I thought that was really interesting.
I got a bit of a Two Doctors vibe from them as well. I think that the main Sontaran, he appeared to be taller than usual. It may just have been a scale or camera angle thing, but he did seem to be more strapping than Dan Starkey, at least.
I thought the humour as well was different as well, because there's obviously a humorous interplay between the two, and it was interesting that the Chibnall didn't try and emulate the sort of interplay that Moffat did, which was just so good, because obviously one of Moffat's skills is always been in his comedy. And he didn't try to sort of emulate that and brought his own sort of approach to it, which I thought was cool.
No, I agree. Recalling what I said earlier on, the thing that I saw him in, John Bishop, was Fearless, which was an ITV drama that starred the late Helen McCrory as a human rights lawyer. It was a very good show, I thought. He only had a relatively small part as a boyfriend, but I've seen him in a couple of things briefly, and he just, I think he's better at that than he is at comedy, to be honest with you. My opinion only. Let's not get hung up on that. I mean, as we said, there's a lot going on in this episode. There's a nice article on the Radio Times website, which possibly lets us quickly summarize these things. There's a number of questions raised. I'm not going to ask James for any answers. I'm just going to go through them and see if he likes the sound of any of these. What's caused the flux? Who is Swarm? What is the division? We kind of know a bit about that already. What is going on with the tunnels in Liverpool? What's wrong with the TARDIS? Did the heart of the TARDIS do anything? Who is Vinda? Is Observation Outpost Rose more than a coincidence? Obviously, they would mention that. Why are the Weeping Angels hunting Claire? Is Dan hiding a secret? What does Azure want with Diane? Why is there a mattress on the floor of the TARDIS? I mean, the list goes on, really. That's just a few of the
And
highlights.
I think while a lot of those stuff is, there's a lot of, there's just, it's really nice to have an episode of Doctor Who where there's just so much you could talk about. And that is rare. And again, I think that comes down to where serial television has become very popular because you can do so much more and you can make it so less predictable because you don't know the conventions. But beyond that, there were some really nice things in there which probably wouldn't have worked in a single episode. I think that I thought that the idea of having a race of dog-like creatures which are there to serve their masters was wonderfully Doctor Who.
It was
You
very
know,
Graham Williams era Doctor Who as well.
yes, it was beautifully done. The I was going to say cosmetics. He looked great, for want of a better word. You see, the 7 years obviously does make a difference when you get older, doesn't it? For the want of a better word, was looked really good. I loved the way he was played as well. I loved the Northern accent worked really well. It gave a little bit of lightness to it. And the balance was really good through the episode as well, because you had the Swarm, which is a very dark character, the Flux, which unusually for Doctor Who has created a sense of tension in an apocalypse which has been long forgotten because we've had so many. But in this apocalypse, where the universe again is under threat, immediate threat, which we've seen several times, Big Bang being the biggest probably, You really felt it.
Yeah, you're actually seeing it, aren't you? I think that's
I
the
didn't really feel
difference.
it in the Big Bang, but in
No.
this, I really feel that you're really playing this to a point where it feels threatened. You're seeing the reaction of people dying on these planets. You're seeing the as you pointed out in the article, the use of the TARDIS's vortex energy, almost seeming like a dribble of energy compared to what it's facing, again heightens the tension. That was brilliant. It was brilliant. I loved. There's just so much to really like in this episode. I thought the characters die. I thought was a really nice character for Dan. I thought that was a really gentle interplay there, and just all those small things made a difference. The jumping around, the opening in Victorian England was a bit of the usual. It was a bit of the same. I kind of feel like I've heard that interplay several times, at least on Big Finish alone. The why are you why forsooth why are you forsooth why are you tunneling into this place? It has no reason. I have a reason. It's beyond you could imagine.
I was getting Ripper Street vibes from it, actually.
Yeah, egad, son. I don't know where they come from, but that to me was a bit formulaic. But you could okay, it was a little bit of setup. If I was to be critical, which I feel I should, so
Go
the
for
one
it.
listener doesn't think we're just gushing.
We've got to
The
one
only,
now.
sorry.
I said, have we got to one listener
Well, we've always
now?
said it's the listener,
Yes, we
really,
have.
so I've
Yes,
just
yes,
been the
yes.
singular, the definitive, you might say.
Oh.
The one, the two things which got me. The first, as I said, was the opener, which I was disappointed in. I think I could see what it was trying to do. It was obviously trying to set up. There's been a period of time that's gone by where Yaz and the Doctor have bonded and work in a way which is different to how they worked before. And it sort of displays some of the slight distrust from Yaz, the Doctor, the sort of the Doctor's tenacity to find to get this information. But the people I was watching it with were very much like, it just seems silly. It seems like it trivializes threat. It feels like a bad James Bond. And the jokes to me were a little cringe. They just didn't work for me. It just didn't work, all the way down to her falling on the mattress, which didn't bother me. The mattress, I mean, obviously, as I think Paul Cornell or someone on Twitter was saying, was noting the mattress as a sort of long staple of Doctor Who now, going back to Survival, obviously. And obviously the Nitro 9 comment as well, which was kind of fun. But it just felt really out of place. And maybe it was so light because they were aware there was quite a lot of dark stuff in there with the Weeping Angels, with Swarm. But it just, again, it highlighted to me the same problem they had with Capaldi, which they constantly have with Jodie, is that they seem to miss where she works. And I know this is a subjective opinion, but for me, those sort of moments, she doesn't work well for me. It doesn't. It just doesn't work. And I don't think
It
that, to
it's
be fair,
Matt
I don't think
Smith
that scene
territory,
would have
isn't
worked
it?
for any of them. Sorry.
It works for Matt Smith. Matt Smith can do
Well,
that sort of thing
yeah, to a
wonderfully.
degree, but I was just thinking if Matt Smith did that scene, I think it would still feel pretty clunky. I could see him, yes, really getting his teeth into it in a way that the others probably wouldn't, apart from maybe Tennant. But I think Eccleston would have felt out of place in that scene. Capaldi would have felt out of place in that scene. I think Jodie felt out of place in that scene. It just doesn't really. It feels like when James Bond just, that sort of craziness of Doctor Who becomes a craziness which feels slightly alien. I don't know. I could imagine Gareth Cavanagh enjoying it for its sort of vaguely Graham Williams-like vibe. I could imagine if technology was able to do it, there'd have been a scene like that with Tom Baker. That I grant that, but it just doesn't really fit. I think where she works best is like when she's a little angry or a little distant, a little cross, with pockets of energy and brightness that sort of play into that. I think that's where she works. When she's on the TARDIS and she's sort of trying to keep things from Yaz, and when she gets quite sort of frosty about it, I think that's where Jodie works really well, when she's doing the serious, not angry serious, but when she's just kind of like someone with secrets. I think that's where they really need to be putting her, because that's where she works best. I think she's, as I've said before, I think she's more of a Davison slash McCoy, with a tiny bit of Troughton, as they all are. than she is a Tom Baker
Yeah.
slash Tennant
Yeah.
slash Matt Smith. And as I've said before, I think Capaldi suffered. So I don't think it's just about Jodie. I think they did the same. I had the same issue with Capaldi, that they constantly keep trying to write the Doctor as a Tom Baker, which Tennant did so well. And you don't need to do that. And I just don't think it fits certain Doctors. And that was, apart from that opener, I thought she was fine. And she can do comedy. You know, the like the nice. I know it's an obvious joke. The synchronize my watch, synchronize our watches. Oh, I don't have a watch. It's been done many times before, but. She lands it. It works. To me, that worked. But the opener didn't. And the only other issue I had with it was Yaz. This is that I know they're trying to build Yaz up a bit, but she just doesn't work for me, I'm afraid. I far preferred Graham. I actually preferred Ryan as well. Yaz just feels, as I've said before, like the formula of the 2005 companion, but there's just nothing left to it. And I kind of feel she's now in the same state as Jenna Coleman was in her last season,
Oh, yeah.
where you don't feel like she's got any reason to be there anymore. That her motivations have been lost. That her she is really she's almost been reduced to the skeleton companion of of questioning the Doctor, so to push that along. And she occasionally can do things which she probably wouldn't be able to do, like open an alien cage, but let's accept that she can. But that's about as much as she does. And I just feel like the character's just not really going anywhere. Maybe Dan will help balance that out and give her something to work against. But I'm afraid that while the acting's fine, I've got no issues there, I just kind of feel the character just, I don't know, just doesn't have enough definitiveness to it to make her sing, which is a shame.
Yeah. I mean, I found it a little bit more preferable, but I suppose there's more focus on her than in previous seasons
I
because.
don't know. I mean, I found I was always worried about this with her, that because they'd set a character up which was a carbon copy of every other companion from 2005, certainly female companion, that when they stripped everyone else away from her, and also maybe because she hasn't had the time to find that relationship with the Doctor, that dynamic, that it would feel wrong. And I think the reason it felt kind of wrong is that I think the writing was forcing us into a position where we were to accept that time had gone by and they were now a team in a different way to the way they were before. But it just didn't feel, I didn't feel that was natural. It just didn't feel quite right to me. I mean, there were pockets where it was good. And as I say, their interplay is good. I've got no issue with the way it's played. I just kind of feel that there's just not enough there. And it could just be simply that it's been 15 years of this similar character all the way through.
Yeah.
And she just feels like Jenna Coleman did in her last season with Capaldi now. It feels like you could just swap the two round and there'd be no difference. Yeah, she's got that same confidence that she can do what she can now. She questions the Doctor. She doesn't really have any agenda to be there. She doesn't really have. Apart from being shown the universe, as the Doctor says again, and it's just like I just, you're just not interesting me, unfortunately. Dan, I'm interested in,
Yeah.
and I'm interested in, was it Claire? Was it Claire? I think it was,
Yes.
wasn't it? The one that we don't know about,
Yeah.
that was interesting, but Yaz, I still have a problem with. But I think it's that is, I know I've talked about it a lot, but those were very trivial problems to an otherwise, as I say. You know, it was a really good episode, and I didn't not enjoy her on the screen, if you see what I mean. I just kind of felt that there was something missing there. There was some sparkle that just wasn't there, and I do wonder whether it's just the characters not being given the space to be developed into something which means something to the audience. And as I say, I think Jenna Coleman had the same problem.
Yeah, quite possibly. One thing that modern Doctor Who has not done very often, was it modern Doctor Who? Doctor Who since 2005 and not done very often, is which is fair enough because it gets silly, is damage the TARDIS. I can only think of two occasions, the Doctor's wife and the Age of Steel, Rise of the Cybermen, that story, when
Outside of regenerations, obviously.
yes. When the TARDIS has come under any some sort of particular stress or attack or whatever, and this episode is both. It seems to be falling apart. There's doors to the outside world all over the place, and then You've got the Flux attacking from the outside. There's a Doctor Who Peter Davison one, isn't there, where the TARDIS falls apart?
Frontiers.
Frontios, yes, of course, yes. That's it was making me think of that a bit.
But then also you'd have like Terminus where it would
Yes.
become fused. It was, obviously invaded in Castrovalva by the Master.
Yeah.
There's been many times where there's been, I suppose there hasn't been that many times thinking about it now, but
It used to happen a lot in the books, certainly in the Virgin
you
books.
certainly did, yes,
Yeah.
absolutely. It reminded me a little bit of Blake Seven and the Liberator and Zen slowly being eaten away by a sort of a corrosive cloud and the way it was starting to drip. And I don't like that console room. I still don't. I try to, but it just one of the reasons I think that they've never gone back to the sort of classic one that they've even used in things like Twice Upon a Time is because it looks very studio based, and yet this console room looks very studio based. It just doesn't work for me. And there's a bit of me which is kind of hoping that it's on its way out. They are actually legitimately breaking it up now,
Yeah.
shattering panels and destroying bits of the ridiculous pillars. I have a horrible feeling I'm going to be disappointed, but I think you're right. I think your main point that it sort of it creates another further sense of urgency,
Yeah.
which is kind of exciting and breaks formula is and creates tension is really really important. I think perhaps if you what if one compares Jodie a little to Davison's Doctor, at the moment perhaps even more like Davison's Big Finish Doctor, where there's a little bit more grumpiness there. I think she works well under threat. I think Davison worked very well under threat, where you feel they're not in control. And I think maybe that's another reason why they wanted to open her, where in the acid bath she is fully in control, to then strip it away through the story. As I say, for me, it didn't quite work. But yeah, I like that vibe. I'm surprised that they're pushing the Timeless Children storyline. I thought that that
Yeah.
would fade into the background more. I'm not bothered by it, as I've said before. I find it an invigorating and interesting, but I do appreciate a lot of people find it frustrating. So I'm surprised that we're going down that route, I must admit.
There is the other element to this is which we've kind of touched upon, but we haven't really, is there is a massive sense of scale to this as well. A lot of Chibnall's episodes have had that jumping back and forth with time zones and the impact typeface on the screen telling you where it is and what year it is and whatever. I think it works better here, not only because you've got the guy in space on his little space station, you've got the stuff in 1820 tunnel digging guy. And Antarctica, and then Earth, and then wherever. But you've got Sontarans, you've got the Weeping Angels, and you've got this space-based threat, and you've got Swarm, and his sister Azure, and it feels a lot bigger, doesn't it, than
Yeah,
many Doctor Who
absolutely.
episodes. I mean, one that maybe should have felt bigger than it was, I
But is
suppose.
that also part of the fact that we have a new framework that allows, so you can have like the Weeping Angels appear, but they're not actually the driving force behind the story. So you've got away from the Doctor lands, discover the monster of the story, problem sorted, move on. Maybe there's a little hint of a bigger arc. You get rid of all of that, and suddenly it's like Doctor Who is doing what it can do. As we've seen other, I mean, I know Dirk Gently was not very popular on Netflix. I didn't think it was too bad, but that was a good example of a series which was serialized. And because it was Douglas Adams playing a post Douglas Adams, but it was playing around with the notion of causality and cause and effect and time and space. It was doing very much what Doctor Who should be doing, and I think it's kind of doing here. So it's kind of cool to see the Weeping Angels appear without feeling at this point they're going to dominate. It was nice to see the Sontarans and enjoy that without trying to work out how it's going to fit into this episode. Yeah, I think, as you say, and I think by doing that, you create a scale because you don't feel like it, you're in these siloed stories where everything that matters really only matters to this story. And that's kind of exciting. And you know,
Yes.
there's a little bit of me which we'd had, you know, where we had the compression of the house, which for a moment was thinking, are we going to see a master here? You know, is that a hint towards that? And it wasn't. And again, so, and I think that's deliberate as well. I think Chibnall is playing some, will play some moves that work against audience expectations, or makes them question, or makes them wonder how it all plays, or who's going to appear. Yeah, I thought it was really smart throughout. And it seems to be the feedback I've seen, obviously bar some comments on Twitter, has been largely positive, which is good.
Yeah, that is good. That's always good. I mean, there isn't an awful lot else we can say about this until, things sort of start moving in subsequent episodes. I just feel very, very satisfied that I watched an episode of Doctor Who produced and written by Chris Chibnall that I didn't feel cross about afterwards. I just enjoyed almost every minute of it. And even the slower sections. Like
Yeah.
your man in space, Vinda, it all
Linda.
felt necessary as well. That's the other thing. Nothing felt like it was there apart from, arguably the opening.
Well, maybe this series as well will help. I mean, I always think it's disappointing when people hate an era. I mean, there was times through Moffat's era I was dissatisfied and I didn't enjoy that. And I was envious of people who had no issues with River Song or the direction. And at the same time, I say, while I'm happy with the Timeless Child story, I think it invigorates, adds mystery, and isn't dissimilar to what Virgin was doing in the 90s anyway. So I've got no issues, but I do know a lot of people are deeply frustrated by it. And if it has to come up again, if this storyline actually gives that more meaning than feeling like a throwaway gotcha slash shock, that's a good thing. That might be a good thing if it makes people who were uncomfortable with that feel that there is something there. I mean, obviously it could frustrate them because they now feel like they're being, it is now being cemented in canon in a way they don't want to. But if it creates a story they enjoy, or is part of a story that they enjoy and has meaning, maybe that will mean that when they watch the Timeless, you know, the back end of season two, they won't feel so frustrated. They'll enjoy it more, and that's a nice thing. So I'm trying to be positive here, and I'm hoping that is going to be the case. I mean, it could totally disappoint all of us for all I know, but that would be a good outcome.
Well, going forward with the series, it would seem likely that the Master will turn up at some point. There are no Time Lords, apparently, thanks to the Master. And we know that there's going to be Cybermen. Are we going to see Daleks? Could the Daleks be behind the Flux? They do have form in trying to destroy the universe, after all.
I would like to see the Daleks actually play a minimal part, and I think they probably will. I think from how this has been set up, and we are only assuming at the moment the Flux is related to Swarm, it could be that the usual players in Doctor Who will be used to show how much bigger scale this is, that the Daleks will be as much threat of this as the Centaurans will probably find out next week, and the Master maybe if he appears. So I'd like to see them done like that. I don't think that would weaken them, providing that everyone else. I think there's a difference between weakening a monster like Gold did to Cybermen to a point where they become impotent as a threat, to actually downscaling their power in a story because there is something bigger that legitimately causes a concern for that race. So I think that's how I'd like to see him. I don't want to see them being the masters behind the Flux, because I think then we're just going to end up going down the same routes as Journey's End, or you know, we've been there. We've been
No,
there
fair point.
when the Daleks are the big bad, and maybe we need them not to be for once.
There's
But that
something else.
doesn't mean we can't have a story where there are threats there.
No, I agree. There's something else we need to talk about. It's Oh no, I've forgotten. Hold on. No, I haven't. That's a joke. The Doctor has had her memory wiped at some point, based on last series, and again by Swarm at some point. He specifically said that he'd wiped memories of him from her mind. That's now there is an element of the War Doctor about this, isn't there? But introducing this whole new villain who we haven't seen before, but the Doctor has, but the Doctor doesn't recognize because she's had a memory wiped. And I'm not sure how comfortable I am with that idea, to be honest with you. I mean, it is a good idea, but it kind of treads over ground that we've seen before recently, and they're getting on for nearly 10 years ago. So it's what do you think of it?
I didn't mind it. I mean, I must admit, I didn't notice that he said that he'd wiped her memory too. I thought he was referring to her mem being aware of her memory being wiped. But I'd have to rewatch that, and I defer to your better memory than mine. I don't mind it so far as I th if it's hard to say at the end of an era. It kind of feels like Chibnall's almost setting pathways forwards, which Moffat did as well, which can sometimes be a mistake because the next person doesn't always embrace them. But it kind of felt to me as if it was sort of like saying, how do we create enemies with mystery, which we don't have to wedge into continuity? And could that be interesting in thinking about characters which know the Doctor far more than they know themselves and that we don't know either? And I think that to some degree is one of the reasons behind Chibnall co-opting this. I mean, I still say, I mean, this, as I say, this is the other sort of storyline stuff that Lance Parkin was playing with, and Andrew Cartmell and all the others of that sort of era, on this idea of there being a previous existence or a previous something of the Doctor that we're unaware about to sort of reinforce the mystery there. And I can see why that's being co-opted in, because it gives you space to play without ending up having to do what Moffat ended up doing for Right or Wrong, which is twisting and changing your act, the continuity you know. And I think to me, it's worse to do, it's not worse. I think there's more detrimental in doing that than there is to actually say there's a continuity we don't know that we can now explore, rather than going, well, let's drop into the end of the 10th planet and show how something happened there that we didn't know about. Let's pocket River Song throughout all the Doctor's history that we never knew about. Let's put Jenna Coleman's character, her name suddenly escapes me for some reason, through all through the Doctor's history as well. And I think in the end you end up cluttering and distorting, which I'm sure is more, it should be more annoying than sort of saying, well, maybe there was stuff that even the Doctor does not know before. So you're not changing anything that the Doctor has said, because the Doctor is unaware of anything before. So you're not, you are changing canon, but you're not changing known canon. And I think that's what this is trying to do. It's trying to set up some new avenues for the show to explore without feeling like it's just becoming, to coin the phrase, the Doctor Who phrase, the fan wank, where you're just, going round and finding ways to pigeonhole things into previous continuity and look clever for it, which can be fun, but ultimately is limiting. So, yeah, I didn't mind it. I didn't mind it. But again, like you said, early days to see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I like the character. I thought the character had potential. I thought he was well played. It felt slightly different to the ones we've seen before. There was a slight chilliness about the character. I thought the way that it sort of wiped, fluxed, wiped, swarmed people out was really interesting. The idea of the sister sounding quite interesting as well. I've not really had that before in a villain, not that I can think of. Yeah, I don't think that the design is particularly memorable. I think it works for the character. But
I was getting Eldrad vibes from the design.
yeah, there is a bit of Eldrad. At first, when I saw him captured, I was thinking, oh God, it's not the villain again from the first episode of Jodie's Realm. Please, no, don't. And it wasn't. And I was relieved, because I think that would have been again. I don't know. I think the bottom line is this series opened up Doctor Who to new possibilities, not just within its format, but again, by exploring this potential era before the Doctor, might open up the, if it's done correctly, might open up the show to new possibilities and new ideas, which after, nearly 60 years, it needs to be doing that. And I think as fans, we should be less precious about that And perhaps, as I say, that's kind of good because it means we're not constantly wedging things in. And one of the issues that people have with Star Trek and Discovery is the feeling that it's wedged in an aesthetic and a storytelling way which is antithetical to that era of their continuity, that the few years before Kirk, it doesn't feel like it fits there. And I understand, I don't mind Discovery, but I can understand why people find that frustrating. So to sort of be creating new stuff that's to do with the Doctor's past, which isn't just sort of ham-fistedly wedging into previous continuities, and also previous kind of previous brands of Doctor Who, because in a weird way, I mean, you could argue, well, there's a lot of space in Matt Smith's era, where we had hundreds of years where he was doing different things which we didn't see. Why can't you deploy it there? But then you're almost interfering with another brand of Doctor Who, the Moffat brand. You're almost interfering and changing his vision in a way that I suppose he kind of did to earlier as himself. But I don't know. I think that's a. I'm not saying it's disrespectful, but it kind of feels like should we be doing that? You know, as artists, if we can help it. If it's got good reason to, that's fine. But should we be trying to avoid meddling too much in the sort of the artwork of? And this is probably another thing for another podcast because there's obviously very good arguments for it as well. But yeah, I kind of like not doing that. I kind of like we're not turning around going, yes, don't you remember me? It was when you're in your third incarnation with all the frills, you know, and that sort of thing again. It's like, really? Do we have to go down there? It's like it's none of that. It's like it's nothing to do with that lot. This is something entirely different. It's fresh. You have no idea, viewers, what this is about. You can't rein this in into any of your many books that you've bought by Lance Parkin and the like that sort of breaks down the history of Doctor Who. No, this is beyond that. You know, get back to the drawing board, Lance. You've got a whole new continuity to fit in here, which would probably suit him fine. Yeah, it feels like a fresh era, doesn't
Yeah, it
it?
does. It
A
does.
fresh era before the fresh era.
Yes. Well, I mean, we're going to wrap it up there, I think. There isn't much more we can draw from this episode that doesn't have sort of relevance later on in the series, by the look of things. Just to leave you with this is that we have a new edition of Brian Terranova's compiled history of the RTD era sonic screwdrivers, which will be uploaded at castorbis.co.uk by the time you hear this podcast. So if you are into sonic screwdrivers, go and grab the latest version of that.
I'm sure I've not seen it, and I'm sure the images will be crystal and beautifully,
Oh, yes.
because he does that so
He
well,
does do.
and he knows his stuff, does.
Yes, beautiful photographs, absolutely. So we'll leave it there, and we'll be back with a review of the second episode of Doctor Who Flux next week. Until then, it's goodbye from us.